Negromania, being an examination of the falsely assumed equality of the various races of men, by John Campbell. Chapter 2. Herodotus. As it is always right to discriminate upon the nature of the evidence from the character of a witness in a court of justice, so it is equally fair to criticise the writings of a historian, to see if he relates what is both probable and possible. Whenever we find an author prone to narrate the improbable and marvellous as being not only true facts and veritable transactions, but furthermore, that he relates these from a personal knowledge of his own, then are we justified in severely criticising all that such authors speak of, and only pay any credit to their assertions, when not contrary to the laws of nature, and when such assertions are confirmed by the testimony of contemporary and subsequent authors and investigators. A case of this kind is now for consideration before us. It has been said that Herodotus is the father of history. If by this is meant that his veracity can be depended upon in his relations of facts, he is certainly unworthy of the title. If it is meant that he is merely the first writer, then his title is correct. Herodotus existed about 430 years before Christ, or about 100 years before the time of the great Macedonian. Herodotus travelled into Egypt and says that, quote, the Egyptians were black in complexion and woolly-headed, close quote. How far he is to be credited must be a question for the readers of this book to determine for themselves, but before I proceed to cite authority against the statement of Herodotus, I will give a couple of quotations from himself in order that a due estimate may be placed upon him. In his Euterpe are to be found the following among a great mass of similar rubbish. Quote, the inhabitants become black from excessive heat. Close quote. In page 121, Bowen's edition is this. Quote, the following is the nature of the crocodile. During the four coldest months, it eats nothing. And though it has 4 feet, it is amphibious. It lays its eggs on land and there hatches them. It spends the greater part of the day on the dry ground, but the whole night in the river, for the water is then warmer than the air and dew. Of all living things with which we are acquainted, this, from the least beginning, grows to be the largest, for it lays eggs little larger than those of a goose, and the young is at first in proportion to the egg, but when grown up, it reaches to the length of 17 cubits, and even more. It has the eyes of a pig, large teeth and projecting tusks in proportion to the body. It is the only animal that has no tongue. It does not move the lower jaw, but is the only animal that brings down its upper jaw to the under one. It has strong claws and a skin covered with scales that cannot be broken on the back. It is blind in the water, but very quick-sighted on land, and because it lives for the most part in the water, its mouth is filled with leeches. Close quote. Again, page 174, quote, the Persians, having marched through the arid region, halted near the Egyptians, as if with a design of engaging. There, the auxiliaries of the Egyptians, consisting of Greeks and Carians, condemned Phanes, because he had led a foreign army against Egypt, adopted the following expedient against him. Phanes had left his sons in Egypt. These they brought to the camp, within sight of their father, and placed a bowl midway between the two armies. Then, dragging the children one by one, they slew them over the bowl. When they slaughtered all the children, they poured wine and water into the bowl, and, after all the auxiliaries had drank of the blood, they immediately joined battle. A hard battle having been fought, and when great numbers had fallen on both sides, the Egyptians were put to flight. Here I saw a very surprising fact, which the people of the country informed me of. For as the bones of those who were killed in that battle lie scattered about separately, for the bones of the Persians lay apart in one place, as they did at first, and those of the Egyptians in another, The skulls of the Persians were so weak that if you should hit them with only one single pebble, you would break a hole in them, whereas those of the Egyptians are so hard that you could scarcely fracture them by striking them with a stone. The cause of this, they told me, is as follows, and I readily assented, that the Egyptians begin from childhood and shave their heads, and the bone is thickened by exposure to the sun. From the same cause, also, they are less subject to baldness, for one sees fewer persons bald in Egypt than in any other country. This, then, is the cause of their having such strong skulls, and the reason why the Persians have weak skulls is this. They shaved them from the first, wearing tiaras for hats. Now, I myself saw that such was the case, and I also observed the same thing at Papremis, with respect to those who were slain with Achaemenes, son of Darius, by Inaros, the Libyan. Close quote. Glidon. Quote, the works of Herodotus and Diodorus are too familiar to general readers to require much more than designation. The former was in Egypt about 430 years BC, during the dominion of the Persians, and after Egypt had fallen entirely from her pristine greatness. The latter was in Egypt in 40 BC, towards the close of the Ptolemaic dynasty, at a still lower period of degradation. Valuable as are the works of these two Greek authors, they have fallen very considerably in our estimation, since Egypt, as a country, and the ancient Egyptians as a people, have become better known to us, and the inconsistencies, misstatements, misrepresentations, misconceptions and absurdities that are hourly exposed in their accounts of Egypt, more than compensate for the information in which, by accident, they are correct. This assertion may seem audacious, but will be substantiated in the sequel, when a comparison is instituted between Egyptian history, as developed in these chapters and future lectures, and the accounts of Herodotus or Diodorus. It would require a volume to elucidate the discrepancies now demonstrable between many, nay most, of the assertions of Herodotus and Diodorus in regard to almost every subject relating to ancient Egypt and the facts with which we are made acquainted in the works of the whole Champollion school. Nor, in common fairness, must my assertions be doubted until an antagonist shall have actually verified in Champollion, Rossellini and Wilkinson some of the points in which Greek authors are shown to be so lamentably ignorant. I will, however, add the following reasons, gleaned chiefly from long personal acquaintance with Egypt, to show that it was not in the nature of things that Herodotus or Diodorus could be often correct. In the first place, Herodotus, though a learned and highly respectable Greek, and who, as the greatest of their ancient travellers and universal historians, deserves our respect and gratitude, was in Egypt a stranger. He was certainly not in literary or scientific or fashionable or aristocratic society in that country, which he visited after intercourse with the Greeks, and the Persian conquest had ruined the former greatness of the higher castes and had corrupted the inhabitants of Lower Egypt, with whom Herodotus chiefly mixed. For his own sake, we must hope he did not, although he says he did, as far as the first cataract, visit Upper Egypt, else he would not have left Thebes undescribed, or have listened to the idle tale that the sources of the Nile were at Elephantine. In his day, 500 years of decline had deteriorated the priestly caste, the only depositaries of history in Egypt. As a foreigner, Herodotus was looked upon by the sinking aristocracy of Egypt in the light of an impure Gentile, and utterly ignorant of the language. He must have gleaned all his information through an interpreter. If, as we have a full right to do, we judge of Herodotus's interpreter by those of travellers in modern times, the result, with respect to the sort of information he could receive through such a medium, may well be imagined. Nay, it is proved, by his mistakes upon almost every Egyptian subject which he handles in Euterpe. Like some English and other modern writers who compose volumes on that misrepresented country that are like Hodge's razors only made to sell, Herodotus prepared his work to read at the Olympic Games to a Grecian audience, more ignorant in those days on Egyptian affairs than even Europeans of modern times are generally, and it was necessary to interlard his discourse with occasional fabrications, some of which will scarcely bear the dubious phrase of se non è vero è ben trovato. Diodorus was in Egypt just before the downfall of the House of Lagus in BC 40, when the decline of Egyptian learning had been going on for 700 years, 400 of which had been spent under the yoke of foreign masters. Diodorus copied Herodotus and Hecataeus of Miletus, who had visited and written on Egypt in the reign of Darius, and perhaps the later work of Hecataeus of Abdera, who was in Egypt after Alexander, and who, from the little we know of him, appears to have been an intelligent man, although to the Egyptians, all of them were nought but impure foreigners, so termed in hieroglyphical legends by the Egyptians, in the same manner that foreign nations are to this day in China termed outside barbarians. Other information was imbibed by Diodorus from Greeks in Lower Egypt, whose profound ignorance of Egyptian learning is only exceeded by their indifference, their stupid self-complacency, and their egregious impudence. It will not be pretended that Diodorus could speak Egyptian. There is so little dependence to be placed on the accounts of Herodotus or Diodorus, excepting on what they actually saw with their own eyes, or could comprehend from its nature when they saw it, that by hieroglyphists their narratives are followed only in the absence of better guides, or when their accounts are confirmed by other testimony. They could not discriminate between the truth or falsehood of the things that were told them, and often the only way of accounting for the nonsense they often record is to suppose that the humorous Egyptians purposely misled them. We have to thank them, however, for putting all down, leaving us the task of culling the pearls from the rubbish, for there is no doctrine, however inconsistent or improbable, that cannot be supported by quotations from Herodotus or Diodorus. Let any stranger, at the present day, through the medium of an interpreter, ask the most intelligent native in the Delta a question about modern Nubia and its present relations with Egypt, and the answer will be a fable, modelled into the form the fellah deems most likely to be pleasing to the stranger. If he does not confess his utter ignorance thereon, a candor rare in the valley of the Nile, and possibly elsewhere. We must not merely look at the authority, but at the authority's resources and qualifications for information, no less than at the nature of the sources whence he could acquire that information. It would surprise anyone to read descriptions of Egypt in some modern works, published since Champollion's discoveries, and then go to Cairo and ask old residents their opinions thereon. The authority of Herodotus and Diodorus on ancient Egyptian, and still more on ancient Ethiopian questions, distant 1,000 miles from the provinces they visited, the epochs of the occurrence of which date from 2,000 to 3,000 years before they were in Egypt, is of about the same value as would be the authority of some modern travellers of the last half century whose puerile information about even modern Cairo would be derived during a fortnight's residence from an Arab rais, or captain, a donkey driver, or a European hotel keeper. Ask any of these last about events which took place in Egypt only 500 years ago. Travellers, therefore, who go beyond the first impressions they receive, are liable to err if they attempt, without time and adequate study, to explain even what they behold. That information must be incorrect, which is solely derived from a village Arab sheikh or Turkish nazir, on events whereon it is impossible, these can possess any information, and which in either case is given to the traveller, ignorant of Arabic, through the medium of a stupid rascal, who, because he can jabber a few words of English, waits at a table and cleans your shoes, is dignified by the inapplicable and inappropriate title of dragoman or interpreter. Let me ask, have not Americans just reason to complain of the cursory notes of English travellers taken during a railroad and steamboat trip throughout the United States? Yet in this case, the traveller speaks the same language as the nation, through whose country he whirls like an ignis fatuus. Judge, then, how incompetent must that traveller be in a foreign land, unacquainted with the language of the natives, when he inquires of unlettered fellers or of European freshmen about events that transpired thousands of years before his visit. And yet such was precisely the position of Herodotus and Diodorus in Egypt. If, therefore, my own assertions differ from those met with in works of any epoch not written by disciples of the Champollion school, the reader will be so indulgent as to make some allowance for diversities of opinion between one who knows a country from 23 years of domicile and many years of critical investigation, and others whose sojourn therein rarely equalled the same number of months, generally fell within the same number of weeks, and often did not exceed the same number of days. When Herodotus or Diodorus are quoted upon subjects which we can prove that they could learn little or nothing about, it is of no great consequence what inference may be derived from their conclusions, because the well-informed hierologists have better sources of information and may draw inferences from existing monuments and Egyptian or Tocton chronicles, which gave them in 1843 an infinitely superior knowledge of early Egypt, dating 2,000 years before the earliest Greek historian, than could be acquired by or was known to the Greeks or the Romans, whose testimony may be very often useful, but it is not evidence. All authors who wrote on Egypt and Ethiopia before the discoveries of Champollion, or without a thorough perusal of the works of his school, are liable to error on subjects now perfectly understood. And in the present year, 1843, for a man to write on ancient Egypt without first making himself really acquainted with what in the last 20 years has been done by the Champollions, by Rossellini, by Wilkinson, and all the hieroglyphical students, is to act out the play of Hamlet, the part of Hamlet being left out by particular desire. Suppose an Egyptian were to write a history of the United States, and to make a rule of never consulting one American author, while treating on American institutions, systems of government, manners and customs, annals or personages, what sort of book would he write? And what opinion would the citizens of the United States have of his one-sided and narrow-minded production, teeming, as it necessarily would, with nonsense, errors, and misrepresentation? And yet it is a deed in absurdity, precisely parallel for anyone in 1843 to write on ancient Egypt without ascertaining first what its ancient inhabitants record of themselves. We have now, however, indisputable evidence of the Asiatic origin and Caucasian race of the earliest denizens of the Nile, and can smile at the long-asserted descent of civilization from Ethiopia, that unknown land of fable, or at the idea of its origin among any African tribe. This will be made clear in the sequel, and this fact will remove a host of dilemmas by tracing Hebrews and Egyptians to a probably simultaneous departure from their common Asiatic hive. It is our part now to prove that not time, nor circumstance, nor climate affected any palpable change or physical alteration in their progeny, and that Ham's lineal descendants, the Egyptians, were all pure-blooded Caucasians, from the earliest to the latest Pharaonic epoch, modified in the Upper Nilotic provinces by the admixture of exotic Austro-Egyptian. That is, as Dr. Morton explains, by compound Semitico-Hindu and equally Caucasian blood. And this was strictly the fact, except in incidental and individual intermixture with the African races of Berbers and Negroes in those provinces to Ethiopia adjacent. This latter commingling, however, appears to have but partially affected the growth of Egyptian population of Asiatic origin, and to have been no more visible, probably still less so, among the Pharaonic Egypto-Caucasian family than it is now discernible among the Fellahs of the lower and middle provinces of the present day. As Mizraim and his children were all Caucasians at first start, in order to change their skins from white to black, their hair to wool, and to alter their osteology through the effects of climate, time at least must be allowed. Who will define the necessary period for these radical changes? Never mind, we grant every facility. Let countless generations transpire. Let them become Negroes or Berbers in race. Let them reach the acme of civilization. Let them surpass Dahomey, outrival Ashanti, become as intellectual as Hottentots, as philanthropical as Turks, as constructive as Tibbous. Let them build the pyramids of Meroe, Gibel, Burkal, and Nuri. Which done, let them come down the Nile again to build the pyramids of Memphis and cover Egypt with stupendous structures, a perfect and essentially a civilized community. To confirm Herodotus and his Egyptian applications of black in complexion and woolly-haired, to be called also the black-footed, or more appropriately, the long-heeled race. On their arrival in Lower Egypt, the delta, of course, is no longer a marsh, and having waited for its formation, they cover it with cities. Let them, I repeat, perform all of these impossibilities, and they are no longer Africans in Egypt. A miracle, of which we have no record, has metamorphosed them again into Caucasians. It does seem odd, if not unnecessary, to make the Asiatic and Caucasian Mizraimites at once proceed up the Nile 1,500 miles to Meroe, there to study and improve and sojourn until the wonderful effects of climate should transmute them into Africans, and then after countless generations to lead them back into Egypt and there witness their transition into pure white men in a climate where no Ethiopian ever changed his skin. And we must make all these changes in far less than 1,000 years. That is, we start with Ham and Mizraim as Caucasians. We transport them from Assyria into Ethiopia and watch their transition into Negroes or Berbers by the effects of climate. And under the vaguest extent of time, we perfect them as such and dote upon the sable or dusky philosophers who are to instruct Moses and civilize the Greeks. We then bring them back into Egypt, and by magic, as it were, transmute these Negroes or Berbers again into pure white men or Caucasians, such as every Egyptian was. We must accomplish all this between Mizraim and Abraham in a space of about 100 years by the Hebrew version, of about 500 by the Septuagint. On Egyptian monuments, as I shall prove by facsimile copies, we find the Negro and the Berber painted prior to 1500 BC as perfectly distinct from the Egyptian natives as an Anglo-Saxon is from a chimpanzee. If 4,000 years have not had the slightest effect in whitening Negroes, how much change of colour could have been accomplished in 1/8 of the time? What should we say if such a doctrine were maintained in defiance of scripture, of nature, and of fact? We should disdain to regard such nonsense. And yet such is precisely the course we must pursue. If Ham be the father of the Egyptians, and the Egyptians descended from Nile, from Ethiopia into Egypt. Such is precisely what must have occurred if we believe Herodotus, Diodorus, and their Roman plagiarists. And such is, in fine, the analysis of the Ethiopian origin of the Egyptians, if we pretend to believe the Bible. I will cast ethnography to the winds. I will discard chronology as a dream. But even then, I confess my inability to comprehend or to accept such a tissue of absurdities, if not profanities. The scriptures inform us that Mizraim came from the banks of the Euphrates into Africa, and that his descendants colonized Lower Egypt. To bring the ancestors of the Egyptians from Ethiopia leads to consequences irreconcilable with primeval biblical migrations. Ham and his son were indisputably Caucasians. To find, therefore, that their Egyptian descendants were Caucasians also is perfectly in accordance with nature and with scripture.